Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and read us in your podcast app.
Right. Glad to be here.
So to start off our deep dive today, I want to pose a question to you right out of the gate. How do entirely new species evolve incredibly complex physical traits, like completely new jaw shapes, to eat entirely different foods and do it in just a few thousand years?
Yeah, that's the big mystery, isn't it?
Because traditional biology, you know, it teaches us that evolution is this slow, grinding process. We're taught it's all about accumulating tiny, random genetic mutations over millions and millions of years.
Exactly, the classic Darwinian model. It's supposed to be a marathon, not a sprint. You basically wait for a beneficial mutation to occur by chance.
And over countless generations.
Right, it slowly spreads through a population.
Right, but imagine this. Just paint a picture in your mind of a species of fish entering a newly formed lake. Suddenly, they are surrounded by, well, entirely new food sources. There's algae on the rocks, there are snails buried in the sand, there are other smaller fish swimming around.
It's an ecological gold rush.
It is, and practically overnight, in evolutionary terms, they change shades to survive and exploit these new menus. So what really happens when a species is faced with a massive ecological opportunity? How could this change our understanding of evolution's speed limit?
It completely flips the script, honestly, on how we view biological adaptation. I mean, we are looking at a scenario where the traditional rules of slow genetic mutations simply do not add up to the extreme physical changes we're seeing in nature.
Yeah.
You only look at the standard mutation rate of their DNA. These fish, well, they shouldn't exist.
But they do. And to answer how they exist, today we celebrate the work of Pooja Singh, Christian Sternbauer, Olli Sehausen, and their collaborative team across institutions like the University of Graz and the University of Bern, who have advanced our understanding of the molecular mechanisms driving rapid adaptive radiation.
Yes, and we're looking specifically at their fascinating paper published in PNAS on May 12, 2026. This team, they essentially built an evolutionary time machine to solve a genetic paradox that's puzzled biologists for, well, decades.
And if we're going to understand that time machine, we really need to define the problem first. The core concept here is adaptive radiation. What exactly does that look like, you know, out in the wild?
Well, adaptive radiation is this explosive evolutionary process. It happens when a single lineage of a species enters an environment with a lot of open, unoccupied ecological niches.
Like those empty food sources we talked about?
Exactly. And they rapidly diversify into many different species to fill those roles. And the ultimate real-world example of this, like the absolute rock stars of adaptive radiation, are the African cichlid fish.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because in each of these lakes, these cichlids evolved radically different jaws. We aren't just talking about the standard jaws in their mouths.
No. We are talking about two entirely distinct sets of jaws. They have their oral jaws, which are the ones you see on their face, you know, used for capturing food.
Right.
But then they have pharyngeal jaws. These are essentially a second set of jaws located further back in their throat.
Like the alien in those movies.
Actually, yeah. Or think of a moray eel, which famously has that second set of teeth that snaps forward. Cichlids have a similar anatomical setup, and the functional decoupling of these two sets of jaws is considered a massive evolutionary innovation.
Wait, why is decoupling them so important?
Because it allows for intense specialization. If your mouth has to be good at catching a fast-moving fish, and also good at slowly crushing a hard snail shell.
It's basically a jack-all-trades, master of none.
Exactly. It ends up being mediocre at both. But if you decouple them, the oral jaws in the front can become perfectly shaped to quickly suck in a smaller fish, while the pharyngeal jaws in the throat evolve into these dense, flat plates specifically designed to crush bone and shell.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this dual jaw system allowed different cichlids to become highly specialized herbivores, carnivores, or scavengers.
And the crazy part is, they convergently evolve the exact same specialized jaw types in entirely different lakes.
Yes.
But we need to talk about the physical setting of this evolutionary drama, because the three Great Lakes of East Africa act as a literal timeline, don't they?
They do. So you have Lake Victoria, which is the youngest. It actually dried up completely and refilled, making its current biological radiation incredibly young. We're talking less than 16,000 years old.
That is just a blink of an eye.
A total blink. Then you have Lake Malawi, which is middle-aged at less than 800,000 years old. And finally, Lake Tanganyika, the oldest, deepest, and most stable of the three, which has been around for up to 3.8 million years.
So, if evolution is usually a slow-cooking recipe passed down through generations, these sichelids in Lake Victoria evolving complex double-jaw systems in less than 16,000 years are somehow using a microwave.
That's a great way to put it.
How are they doing it without waiting for new genetic ingredients? I mean, if their genes aren't mutating fast enough, my first thought is, where do researchers even begin to look for the answer?
And that was the exact hurdle. Because the DNA sequence itself, the master genetic code, wasn't changing fast enough, the researchers had to look at gene regulation. It's not about what genes you have, it's about how those genes are being used.
Okay.
So to capture this, they analyzed 200 transcriptomes.
Wait, hold on. A transcriptome? How is that different from a genome?
Good question. Think of the genome as the master reference library of DNA locked inside the cell's nucleus. It contains every instruction to build the fish, but it just sits there.
Like the blueprints.
Exactly. A transcriptome, on the other hand, is a snapshot of all the RNA being produced at a specific moment. RNA acts as the photocopies of the specific books being checked out of the library and actively read.
So it's what's actually happening right then.
Right. Sequencing a transcriptome tells you exactly which genes are actively turned on and how they are behaving in a specific tissue at a specific time.
Okay, I get it. But how do you capture that in a developing fish? Are they just taking whole fish and, like, tossing them in a blender to look at their RNA?
No, and that's the brilliant part of their methodology. They didn't look at the whole fish, and they didn't look at adult fish. They meticulously dissected and sequenced the oral and pharyngeal jaws, specifically from stage 26 larvae.
Stage 26, that seems incredibly specific. Why that stage?
It is a critical developmental window. At stage 26, the larvae have just absorbed their yolk sac. The cartilaginous and bony elements of their jaws have physically formed, but they are in this period of intense active growth.
Oh, so the machinery is running at full speed.
Exactly. It's the exact moment when the genetic instructions are shouting the loudest to shape the final structure of the jaw. By sampling at this stage, the researchers captured the raw construction process in action.
That is so smart.
And they sampled 20 different species across the three lakes, representing all these different jaw shapes, plus older non-rate-eating species that stayed in the surrounding rivers and never underwent this explosive diversification.
So they have all this RNA data representing the active construction of these jaws. And they map these RNA reads to a reference genome to compare two very specific genetic processes, gene expression and alternative splicing. Let's make sure everyone is completely clear on the mechanics here. Can you break down the biological difference between those two?
Absolutely. Gene expression, or GE, is basically like a volume dial on a speaker. It turns the production of a specific protein up or down.
Like making more or less of it.
Right, so if a sichelid needs a thicker, heavier jawbone to crush snails, gene expression simply turns up the volume on the bone-building genes. Alternative splicing, or AS, is entirely different. It's more like a film editor cutting and pasting a single gene recipe to create entirely different versions of a protein.
Wait, really? One single gene can physically make multiple distinct proteins?
Exactly. Genes are not solid blocks of code. They are made of distinct segments called exons, separated by non-coding regions called introns. When the cell makes that RNA photocopy, a cellular machine actually splices the code, cutting out the introns and pasting the exons together.
Oh, I see.
And alternative splicing allows the editor to mix and match those exons. It might skip an exon entirely. So gene A doesn't just make protein A. Depending on how the editor cuts the film, it can make protein A1, A2, or A3.
And these different versions are the isoforms.
You got it. These customized versions of the protein are called isoforms.
What's incredible is how they proved which of these two processes was responsible for the rapid evolution.
What's fascinating here is that the research team didn't just look at these processes in a vacuum. They modeled the evolutionary variance of both gene expression and alternative splicing across a phylogenetic tree.
And for those who might be a little rusty, a phylogenetic tree is basically an evolutionary family tree, right?
Correct. It traces the ancestry of all these sichelid species back through time to their common ancestors, branching off into distinct clades, which are just groups of organisms that evolved from a common ancestor.
Right.
By mapping the RNA data onto this family tree, they could see exactly when and where specific genetic changes occurred throughout history.
And the results they got back are just mind-blowing. The big reveal of this entire deep dive is that alternative splicing evolved significantly faster than gene expression.
much faster. Mm. When they looked at the evolutionary constraints, gene expression acted the way traditional biology expects it to. It stayed relatively stable, and it mostly grouped by tissue type, meaning the volume dials for an oral jaw looked broadly similar across different species.
But alternative splicing was different.
It was wildly divergent. It evolved rapidly and grouped the samples strictly by species and their specific diets. It was the primary rapid-fire driver separating these young, rapidly evolving species.
But where did these new splice variations, like these brand new isoforms, where did they come from? Did the fish just randomly mutate a new way to edit their genes overnight?
This is where the team looked at the ancestral toolkit. They found a staggering statistic. 86% of the overall genes and 73% of the specific spliced isoforms they found in the rapidly evolving lake cichlids, they were already present in the older river species.
The ones that never radiated.
Yes, the ones that stayed the same.
I'm struggling to wrap my head around this. If this genetic noise is just sitting there in the river fish, why doesn't it change their jaws? Why does it only activate in the lake?
It comes down to selective pressure. Imagine a population of fish in this stable, ancient river. Occasionally, a gene splices a bit weirdly, creating a rare alternative isoform, a slightly different protein. Because the river environment is stable, this rare isoform doesn't give the fish an advantage, but it also doesn't harm it. There's no evolutionary penalty for it. So it just hangs around in the gene pool at very low frequencies, acting as biological noise.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Wait, so what was previously thought to be just random, harmless biological noise actually turned out to be a secret evolutionary toolkit waiting to be used?
Precisely. When those river fish swam into the newly formed lakes, suddenly the rules changed. There were massive, empty ecological niches. That low-level biological noise became incredibly valuable.
Ah.
The environment shifted and a process called directional selection kicked in.
Right. Directional selection is when the environment actively rewards one extreme trait, right?
Yeah.
Like if the only food available is hard snails, the environment strictly favors fish with the thickest jaws.
Exactly. Directional selection grabbed hold of those rare alternative isoforms. Suddenly, a fish expressing a specifically spliced protein had a massive advantage in scraping algae off rocks. So that fish survived better, reproduced more, and that specific isoform surged in frequency across the population to build these new specialized jaws.
It's like a Swiss Army knife.
Mm-hmm.
In the stable river, the fish only ever needed the basic knife blade to survive. The corkscrew and the scissors were always tucked inside their DNA, totally ignored. But the second they get dropped into a new lake where they suddenly need to cut algae, they don't have to wait millions of years to invent scissors. They just deploy the tool that was already hiding in their pocket.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. But to be clear, it wasn't exclusively ancestral noise. They also found some brand new evolutionary innovations.
Really?
Yeah, the researchers identified 34 potentially novel isoforms that were completely absent in the non-radiating river species. These evolved remarkably fast within the lakes.
Do we know what any of those new isoforms actually do?
We do. A standout example from the paper is the COL21A1 gene, which is involved in tissue formation. The main standard isoform of this gene is found in herbivores across all the lakes.
Okay.
But a novel alternative isoform of this exact gene appeared specifically in Lake Victoria cichlids, and it is directly tied to their hypertrophied or heavily enlarged lips.
Enlarged lips?
Yeah, big fleshy lips, which actually helps them feed in the rocky crevices of that specific lake.
Wow. And that brings us to the timeline effect, which I think really seals the deal on this theory. Because comparing the young lakes to the old lake shows us exactly how evolution shifts its strategies over time. Lake Victoria and Lake Malawi, the younger lakes, relied heavily on the alternative splicing rapid response team to diverge their jaw shapes. But what about Lake Tanganyika, the one that's nearly 4 million years old?
Lake Tanganyika showed a completely different dominant pattern. While it still utilized some splicing, it relied far more heavily on slow gene expression changes. To give you the exact numbers from the paper in Lake Tanganyika, there were 5,506 differentially expressed genes in the oral jaws between their herbivores and carnivores.
Okay.
In the much younger Lake Victoria, only 1,792.
Let's contextualize those numbers for a second. Over 5,000 differentially expressed genes in Tanganyika. That is a massive, complex genetic overhaul. It's a ground-up renovation of the jaws architecture.
It is.
But Lake Victoria achieved its radical jaw shapes with a fraction of that genetic change, purely by leaning heavily on the alternative splicing mechanism.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it tells us that alternative splicing and gene expression play distinctly different sequential roles in evolution.
How so?
Well, alternative splicing acts as the rapid response team. When a new environment opens up, splicing provides the immediate quick fix, utilizing that ancestral noise to allow for rapid adaptation and speciation.
And gene expression.
Gene expression is the long-term maintenance crew. Over millions of years, it slowly fine-tunes those physical traits, dialing the volume up and down across thousands of genes to perfect the adaptation.
The rapid response team builds the initial rough draft of the new jaw, using the film editor, and the maintenance crew spends the next few million years adjusting the thousands of volume dials to get it just right. It is a stunningly elegant system.
It really is beautifully complex.
But I know no study is perfect, and this one relies on some very specific parameters. What are the limitations here, and what do the researchers say we need to look at next?
The authors are very clear and transparent about the constraints of their work. They only looked at one specific developmental phase, those stage 26 larvae, and they focused almost exclusively on the jaw tissues. While jaws are incredibly important for ecological adaptation, they're just one part of the fish.
Right, a fish is more than just a mouth.
Exactly. So, suggested next steps include studying multiple life stages, from early embryonic development all the way through to the adult fish, to see if splicing plays different roles at different ages. They also suggest using advanced functional genomics, specifically things like GUS or splice QTLs.
Okay, let's define those. GUS stands for genome-wide association studies, right? But how does a splice QTL actually help us?
Think of a splice QTL as a highly specific genetic treasure map. QTL stands for quantitative trait locus. It doesn't just tell us that a splice happened, it traces the exact coordinate in the DNA sequence that caused the cellular editor to make that specific cut.
Oh, that's incredibly precise.
Very. By mapping these, researchers can definitively link a single genetic variant to a specific physical change in the jaw.
And we can't talk about jaw development without mentioning why this matters to us, sitting here with our own human jaws. Because there's a deeply surprising clinical relevance to this fish study.
There really is. The genetic pathways that govern craniofacial development, how the skull, jaws, and face physically form in an embryo, are highly conserved across all vertebrates.
So fish and humans share this?
Yes. That means the deep genetic pathways building a cichlid jaw are profoundly relevant to how human faces develop in the womb. Remember that COL21A1 gene we mentioned?
The one that created a novel spliced isoform for big lips in late Victoria cichlids.
That's the one. In humans, mutations in that very same gene are associated with human cleft lip syndrome.
That is wild. The same genetic toolkit that allows a fish to rapidly adapt its mouth to scrape algae off a rock in a new lake is linked to developmental conditions in human faces.
It is a powerful reminder of our shared biology. This raises an important question for the broader scientific community. It proves that biology needs to move away from purely looking at gene expression.
We've been missing half the picture.
Exactly. For decades, we've been so focused on the volume dial that we've completely ignored the film editor. We have to adopt a more holistic view that includes the immense rapid power of alternative splicing if we want to truly understand how life adapts.
So what does this all mean? If we have to boil this entire massive time-traveling study down into a single takeaway, well, how would you put it?
I would summarize it like this. Alternative splicing acts as a rapid evolutionary catalyst, allowing species to repurpose ancestral genetic noise into critical physical adaptations almost overnight. While gene expression fine-tunes these physical changes over millions of years, it is the flexibility of alternative splicing that provides the immediate biological toolkit for explosive biodiversity.
It's beautiful, honestly. The idea that evolution isn't just about waiting around for a lucky new mutation to strike, but about creatively remixing the messy, noisy history already written in a species' DNA. Those fish didn't have to wait a million years to find a new chase, they just had to unlock the hidden drafts of their own genetic manuscript. Which leaves us with this thought. What does this mean for how we view the junk or noise hidden inside our own human genomes, especially as we face sudden environmental shifts of our own?
It's something we're definitely going to have to figure out.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
switch to turn and stay. Not a brand new page, just a different red, hidden in the margins like a seated need. Low and rare, it lingers out of sight, then it rises when the timing's right. Old notes, new bites, watch the shape change fast. Ancient little variants waking from the past. Cut and stitch the message, make it fit the fight. One body, many answers in a single line. Old notes, new bites, feel the future bite.
Thank you.